American and Filipino servicemen lined up in a tunnel near the infirmary of a small island fort at the mouth of Manila Bay. The 60 or so men were receiving yellow fever shots being administered by the fort's medical staff, including Major Lloyd Goad, a 28-year-old army doctor with brown hair and a pleasant but shy smile. They heard the Japanese artillery shells that were falling all over the island, their sounds echoing through the tunnels and concussions shaking dust off the ceilings. The men felt safe in that tunnel, separated from the bombardment by 18 inches of reinforced concrete. But then, a 240-millimeter shell cut through that concrete barrier, landing in the middle of the queue. The explosion threw men into the air as they scattered in all directions. Some men died instantly, others suffering massive physical trauma as shrapnel and more hit the falling men. That moment was Major Goad's first test of wartime medicine as he struggled to help and, hopefully, save more than 60 injured and dying men. This is Left Behind. Welcome to Left Behind, where I share stories of individuals left behind when the U.S. surrendered the Philippines in the early days of World War II. I'm your host and researcher, Anastasia Harmon. My great-grandfather, Almasam, was one of those POWs, and his memoir inspired me to tell the stories of his fellow captives. For those of you who listen every week, I'm sure you've noticed that I've been a bit sporadic in publishing new episodes lately. And I apologize for that. I was quite sick for the last 2 weeks of March, and then I was on vacation in Texas to see the total eclipse for the first 2 weeks of April. So I fell a bit behind. And I have a great lineup of episodes scheduled for the next month and a half that I think you're going to absolutely love. Starting with today's episode, which tells the story of two men who served on and then were captured on a small island in Manila Bay. Their story offers a unique glimpse into the war on small island outposts in the Philippines and away from the hot spots of Corregidor and Bataan. So let's jump in. Louis Napoleon Boudreau, a French-Canadian by birth, entered the world on May 17, 1888, in the coastal village of Petite Rochie, New Brunswick, Canada. Parents Philemon and Salome Baudreau were farmers. Napoleon, as the young man went by throughout his life, was their sixth child. 20-year-old Napoleon Boudreau, standing at 5'9" with blue eyes, light brown hair, and a ruddy complexion, came to the United States in 1908, where he entered the U.S. Army. At some point in his life, he attended the University of Sacred Heart, where he majored in math and humanities. Details of his early army service are spotty, but we do know that he was assigned to the Philippines in 1909 to 1911, and while there, assisted in building Fort Wint, which is an island fort in the Philippines, which we'll hear more about later. After that, he was likely stationed in or near Astoria, Oregon, around 1914, because he married 18-year-old Abigail Jane Heckard there on August 9, 1914. Normand Boudreau, Napoleon and Abigail's son, was born on June 3, 1917. Sadly, though, he died the same day. Then Abigail died about 5 weeks later, and I wonder if that was from childbirth complications. Even more tragic, Napoleon never saw his son. And he was not with Abigail when she died. In fact, I believe he was already in Europe fighting in World War I when they passed. After the war, Napoleon had the following inscribed on Abigail's gravestone.
In memory of my beloved wife, into whose dying eyes, upon whose death-laid form I never gazed, and my child who I never saw, in the grave with its mother, my soul to God, my heart to you.
Now, I haven't found specific details of Napoleon's World War I service, but I do know that he was in Europe, and he earned the rank of captain by November 1918, which was the end of the war. He returned to Astoria, Oregon after the war, and in January 1920, Napoleon married Myrtle Heckard, who was the younger sister of Napoleon's first wife, Abigail. By 1930, Napoleon and Myrtle lived in New York City, and he may have worked as a professor of military tactics at Fordham University during this time period. The couple then spent a couple years on Corregidor Island in the Philippines, where Napoleon commanded a coast artillery unit. And then they were assigned to Indianapolis, Indiana in 1935, where Napoleon organized the state's National Guard and seems to have been well known and well respected by the people in Indianapolis. In May 1940, Major Boudreaux received a new but very familiar assignment, commander of Fort Wint near Manila in the Philippines. So he was now in command of the fort he helped establish some 30 years previous when he was there from 1909 to 1911. Napoleon's wife Myrtle followed him to the Philippines, and they both lived on Grande Island, but she was evacuated in the summer 1941 back to the United States with the other officers' wives and children. 6 months before Major Boudreaux married his first wife, a baby boy named Lloyd Henry Goad was born December 18, 1913, in Elston, Iowa. Baby Lloyd was the oldest of Rosa and James Goad's two sons. Father James was a physician, and the Goad family seems to have been well off. For example, in 1930, the family not only had a live-in housekeeper, but their Gary, Indiana home was worth $20,000, which was 2 to 3 times the value of their neighboring homes. And you'll recall that 1930 is well into the Great Depression. Lloyd graduated from Mann High School in the early 1930s, then attended the Indiana University School of Medicine. By 1940, he was a resident at the Oklahoma City General Hospital. But Army service came calling, and in February 1941, he joined the U.S. Army and soon found himself at the U.S. military's Sternberg General Hospital in Manila. Japanese airstrikes hit the Navy Yard and the Army airfields near Manila starting on December 10, 1941. Wounded sailors and soldiers poured into Sternberg General Hospital, where Major Lloyd Goad of the U.S. Army Medical Corps would have been focused on shrapnel wounds and burns from the airfield explosions, bullet wounds from aircraft strafing, and even more horrific situations. It was probably the first time he'd encountered the wounds and devastation of war. But Major Goad's fight was to save his patients, the servicemen sacrificing themselves in these first days of World War II. Helping him were U.S. Army and Navy nurses, including Rosemary Hogan, whose story I covered in episode 40. As December progressed, the city around him was under attack, as Japanese invasion forces moved ever closer to Manila. Airstrikes, bombings, strafing. They all became commonplace in Manila as Christmas 1941 neared. The Japanese infantry was swiftly approaching the capital city. Then, the U.S. ordered all military personnel, medical staff included, to retreat from Manila. Thus, Major Goad likely found himself among the medical caravan of doctors, nurses, patients, and other staff, making their way from Manila to the Bataan Peninsula in the days after Christmas 1941. While Major Goad was fighting to save lives in Manila, Colonel Napoleon Boudreaux was fighting to defend Fort Wint. Fort Wint sat on Grande Island in the Philippines' Subic Bay. It protected Subic Bay's entrance with heavy coastal artillery that could reach the Bataan Peninsula, making the island fort an important and strategic defense position. During the years leading up to World War II, Fort Wint was a coastal artillery training ground. In November 1941, so several weeks before the Pearl Harbor attack, Colonel Boudreaux oversaw daily coastal artillery and anti-aircraft practice sessions at Fort Wint. Because the coastal artillery at Fort Wint could reach land targets on Bataan Peninsula, that artillery would have been useful to slow down Japanese ground troop progress down the peninsula. But that didn't happen. As I explained in more detail in episode 34 about Chet Britt, who was also stationed at Fort Wendt, Colonel Boudreau received orders to withdraw from the island fort during the same time that the rest of the Allied forces were withdrawing to Bataan. And that was a strategic error. Abandoning Fort Wendt handed the Japanese an important defense point, and it gave up heavy artillery that could have assisted the Bataan defense effort. It was an unfortunate blunder. And after the war, no one seemed to know who ordered Fort Wendt's evacuation. Some historians suspect that someone at headquarters mistakenly assumed that Fort Wendt personnel should retreat too, since the fort was north of the Bataan retreat line. But regardless of who ordered it, evacuate to Bataan, the Fort Wendt men did. However, Colonel Boudreau wouldn't find himself on the peninsula for very long. No, very soon he'd be in command of another island sentry. Sitting atop the sheer 100-foot cliffs of Carabao Island, Fort Frank was one of four island fortresses, including Corregidor's Fort Mills, that guarded the entrance to Manila Bay at the outbreak of World War II. Collectively, these four islands were known as the Harbor Defenses. Besides Fort Frank and Corregidor, the other two harbor defense forts were Fort Hughes, which was relatively close to Corregidor's tail end. Its artillery guns could reach Corregidor, and the men and artillery stationed there helped defend the island from invasion on May 6, 1942. It's also the island that Captain John Morrill and his crew set out from when they escaped Manila Bay in the open-air diesel boat, which I covered in episode 48. The other island was Fort Drum, which was nicknamed the Concrete Battleship. In the 1910s, the small, boulder-shaped, rocky island was leveled by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, and a reinforced, concrete, battleship-shaped fort was built on top of it. I've put before and after pictures of this fort on the website, and you can find the link in the show description. It's strange looking. Fort Frank was situated nearly 10 miles south of Corregidor, at the mouth of Manila Bay, on the solid rock Carabao Island, which was situated just 500 yards off the Luzon coast. Luzon, as you probably know, is the Philippines' largest island and home to Manila and Bataan. Most of Carabao Island sits 100 feet above sea level, on solid rock, which suits up from the water in steep cliffs, except for in one very small area. Colonel Boudreau was in command of Fort Frank by early January 1942, and Major Lloyd Goad was part of the medical team on the island. From January through April 1942, Japanese forces laid siege to Fort Frank and the other harbor defense forts/islands. Fort Frank was mainly equipped with armor-piercing artillery to attack incoming ships. Although it had some anti-aircraft weapons, the island fort remained quite vulnerable to air attack. Fort Frank, however, wasn't a main target. Once Bataan fell, the majority of air attacks were aimed at Corregidor. Luckily for the approximately 400 American and Filipino military personnel stationed there, much of Fort Frank was underground and connected by tunnels hewn into the island's rock. So the four-month siege from January to May 1942 saw little loss of life. However, diseases, malaria, dysentery, yellow fever, were likely the biggest health problems at Fort Frank during Goad's time in the infirmary there. In fact, diseases were the cause of most of the fort's casualties during the four-month siege. By early February 1942, Japanese forces had moved heavy artillery into Luzon Island's Cavite Province, which coastline was very close to the harbor defense islands. Thus, in early February, Japanese began shelling Fort Frank and the other harbor forts on a daily basis, going well into the middle of the month. The artillery attacks followed a pattern. They'd open fire in the mornings, and then the harbor fort's artillery answered with their own guns. But the Japanese soon discovered a new way to target Fort Frank. World War II military historian Lewis Morton wrote,
Learning from the natives that the fort received its supply of fresh water from a dam near Kalumpan on the Cavite shore, the Japanese dispatched a demolition squad to locate and destroy the pipeline. On 16 February, the Japanese found the line and pulled up the section just below the dam. Fort Frank, fortunately, had its own distillation plant, and Colonel Boudreau directed that it be placed in operation at once. But its use required valuable fuel, and Boudreau was understandably reluctant to expend the gasoline he needed for his guns to distill seawater. On the 19th, therefore, he made an effort to repair the pipeline and sent a group of 15 volunteers to the mainland for that purpose. Before the men could restore the line, they were attacked by a Japanese patrol of about 30 men. In the fight that followed, the Americans and Filipinos, with the support of 75mm guns from Fort Frank, destroyed the entire patrol, suffering only one casualty. The 15 men then returned to Fort Frank safely, but without having accomplished their mission. That night, the Japanese retaliated by burning the barrio of Kalumpan. It was not until 9 March that Colonel Boudreau was able to repair the broken water pipe.
Not long after the pipe was fixed, the Japanese stepped up their artillery campaign against the harbor defense islands, with Fort Frank and Fort Drum, that's the concrete battleship, receiving the brunt. At 7:30 on the morning of March 15th, 1942, 240mm howitzers opened fire on Fort Frank. The bombardment continued until afternoon, with 500 shells falling on Fort Frank that day, all but destroying 3 artillery batteries. American efforts to neutralize the shelling were unsuccessful. And that intense shelling lasted for more than 6 days, with the heaviest bombardment coming on the 16th and the 21st. On March 16th, a 240mm shell penetrated through 18 inches of concrete near one of Fort Frank's batteries. It went under a 6-foot concrete wall and then exploded in the powder room. That explosion destroyed the room, upturning 60 cans of mortar powder. Somehow, none of those cans exploded. 5 days later, on Saturday morning, March 21st, 1942, Fort Frank's servicemen queued in a tunnel near the infirmary to get yellow fever shots. A 240mm Japanese shell penetrated the tunnel's 18-inch thick concrete roof, landing right where the soldiers waited. 28 men died and another 46 were wounded, and that was the greatest number of casualties that Fort Frank suffered during the war. As a medical officer, Major Goad would have been intensely involved with assisting the wounded and dying men. Fearing a Japanese ground invasion of the island, Colonel Boudreau doubled the island's beach defenses. But that attack never came. However, Japanese General Homa had planned to capture the fort, but canceled that invasion to assemble more units on Bataan for the final assault on the peninsula, which began in early April. After Bataan Peninsula fell on April 9, 1942, Japan turned their air bombardment focus to Fort Frank and the other 3 island fortresses defending Manila Bay, which were the only remaining Allied strongholds near Manila. But, as you know, Allied defenses of those islands lasted only a few weeks. On May 6, 1942, Japanese troops invaded Corregidor, the largest of the defense islands, and America surrendered all of the Philippines to Japan. I describe details of this invasion in episode 44. Before the surrender, Colonel Boudreau oversaw destruction of Fort Frank's artillery and other weapons so that the Japanese could not use them. A newspaper later reported, "The surrender news came by coded radiogram from General Wainwright," Colonel Boudreau said, "and firing ceased. Several hours later, the Japanese arrived at Fort Frank in 13 evasion boats and assumed control. Colonel Boudreau was required to turn over his personnel roster to a young lieutenant who thought it was a great joke to have captured Napoleon. The colonel had to guide his captors on a tour of the fort." The Fort Frank POWs, including Goad and Boudreau, were eventually transferred to Corregidor to join the other men captured on that island and the other harbor defense islands. After captured, Lloyd Goad probably worked with other American doctors, nurses, and medics, either in the 1,000-bed tunnel hospital underneath Corregidor Island's Malinta Hill, or treating sick patients at the 92nd garage area where the POWs were held. The Corregidor invasion had resulted in heavy casualties on both sides, and the Malinta Hospital treated ally and enemy servicemen alike. In the first few weeks of captivity, Goad and the other medical staff saw increasing numbers of men suffering from diseases, dehydration, and malnutrition due to the unsanitary conditions of the POW's camp on Corregidor. I describe conditions at this camp in episode 50. Finally, after nearly a month of captivity on the island, the American POWs left Corregidor. Major Goad again entered Manila, only this time as a POW on parade in a Japanese show of military might to the Filipino people. After a night's rest in Manila, he boarded a cramped, stifling train for a 70-mile journey to Cabanatuan City. The next day brought a 16-mile march to the Cabanatuan POW camps. The march was brutal, as six starving, exhausted POWs trudged along a dirt road, up hills and downhills, under the relentless Philippine sun. Many men dropped along the way, including my own great-grandfather, Almasong, who later wrote,
"I recovered consciousness with a medic kneeling by my side. He had a small pocket medical kit for personal use and revived me with some preparation he administered. The column had disappeared up the dusty road and were out of sight. He had been permitted by one of the new guards to remain with me."
Salm identified that medical officer as Dr. Goad. And I, personally, will forever be grateful to Goad for his compassion toward my great-grandfather. A half hour later, a truck picked up the fallen POWs, including Salm and Goad, and took them to the Cabanatuan POW Camp Number 3. There they rested in the shade of a small tree and waited for the marching POWs to arrive. At first, Cabanatuan had three POW camps, all of them overseen by a Japanese commander. Upon arrival at Cabanatuan Camp Number 3, Colonel Napoleon, as the Japanese called him, became the camp's first American commander. He oversaw the organization and administration of the roughly 2,000 POWs in that camp. When Colonel Boudreau and his fellow POWs arrived, the camp was barren, with only empty barracks to house the POWs. Colonel Boudreau assigned other American officers to help administer various camp needs. They created cooking protocols, sanitation infrastructure, medical facilities, and other ways to meet needs of POWs. Basically, the Japanese made sure that the POWs remained in camp and performed various off-site work details, and then they issued punishments for infractions. The American camp commander made sure the POWs had somewhat livable circumstances. But despite Colonel Boudreau's work to improve camp conditions, summer 1942 was very difficult. Major Lloyd Goad and the other camp medical personnel established a camp hospital, but they faced a daunting task at Cabanatuan, stemming the tide of disease and malnutrition that plagued the camp's occupants. With insufficient drinking water, disease-carrying insects, and horrifically insanitary latrines, conditions were ripe for serious health problems. Then, the Bataan Death March survivors arrived, and Goad and the other Corregidor POWs realized just how lucky they themselves had been. One of the camp medical directors described,
"Along the road came a ragged formation of dirty, unkempt, unshaven, half-naked forms, pale, bloated, lifeless. Limbs grotesquely swollen to double their normal size. Bare feet on the stony road, some stark naked, bloodshot eyes and cracked lips, smeared with excreta from their bowels."
1,287 American POWs died at the three Cabanatuan POW camps during June and July 1942, the camp's first 2 months of operation. The camp hospital's first death-free day wouldn't come until December. And Major Goad was in the middle of it all. My great-grandfather described Colonel Napoleon Boudreau as an amiable commander and a fine, understanding officer. But the colonel's command of Camp Number 3 lasted only 3 months. In August 1942, Camp No. 3 closed, and the POWs, including Major Goad and my great-grandfather, were transferred to Gabanatuan Camp No. 1, about 10 miles away. But the Japanese had different plans for Colonel Napoleon. They sent him to Karenko POW Camp in Formosa, which is present-day Taiwan. This camp was an officer's camp. Japan had a theory. Separate Allied high-ranking officer POWs from the lower-ranking men so that the lower-ranking POWs would be easier for the Japanese to control. With Colonel Boudreau at this camp were General Jonathan Wainwright, who took over command of Allied forces in the Philippines when MacArthur was evacuated to Australia, and General Edward King, who surrendered Bataan. I told King's story in episode 24. Karenko POW Camp also imprisoned governors and other officials from countries that Japan had conquered. As senior officers, the POWs were by and large older men. Colonel Boudreau was 54 when he arrived. General Wainwright was 59. The Japanese humiliated, beat, and worked these older men hard at the camp's farm, where they herded goats and grew food that would then be confiscated by the Japanese guards. Food and medical supplies were withheld. One imprisoned officer stated,
"The food was very bad, and the treatment worse."
Conditions at the VIP camp were so bad that when the Red Cross requested to visit the officers' camp, some 100 POWs were temporarily relocated to a different camp for the Red Cross visit. Of course, those men returned to Karenko after the visit. Colonel Boudreau reported that
only a few Red Cross packages were delivered to the prisoners, and almost all packages from home had been looted. He heard from Mrs. Boudreau but twice in 3 years. She received only a few stereotyped cards.
Mrs. Myrtle Boudreau received the first of those letters in August 1943, more than 2 years after her husband was taken prisoner. In that letter, he said,
"I am interned in Taiwan. My health is excellent. I'm working in the garden for exercise. My love to you, Napoleon Boudreau, February 20, 1943.
If you notice the two dates, it took 6 months for those few short lines to arrive home. At some point, Colonel Boudreau was moved to another officer camp in present-day Taiwan, where he spent a year doing hard labor. In spring 1945, he was again moved, this time to the Houghton POW camp, which was the largest Japanese camp in Manchuria, in present-day China. The camp was in an industrial area near Mukden City. Arriving at the same time was Chet Britt, who, at the start of the war, had served under Colonel Boudreau's command at Fort Wint on Grande Island. Work at this camp was lighter than at Boudreau's previous camps, and food, being served 3 times a day, was much better and much more plentiful. In early August 1945, the Russian Red Army invaded Manchuria and arrived at the Houghton camp on August 19th or 20th. A Russian captain entered the camp, saying,
"From this moment on, you are free men."
That captain then went on to tell the POWs how the Russians had left the Western Front to liberate their American friends. Boudreau later told a newspaper that
joy and hilarity reigned over the camp following his announcement, and the Japanese surrendered their arms and ammunition, food, and medical supplies to the conquerors. 50 Japanese guards were marched in front of their former captives, a very docile, apologetic group of men.
U.S. POW recovery teams also arrived, and the Russians and Americans worked together to evacuate the camp's 1,300 POWs. Some VIPs and very sick POWs were evacuated by air. Most, however, I believe including Colonel Boudreau, left the Houghton camp by train on September 11th and 12th, 1945. They then boarded Navy ships for Okinawa. En route, they were deloused, got new clothes, and received medical and dental treatment. From Okinawa, the POWs sailed for America. After 40 months as a prisoner of war, 57-year-old Colonel Boudreau weighed just 110 pounds, having lost some 50 pounds during his imprisonment.
Nothing has been exaggerated,
he told a reporter, regarding the treatment of American prisoners in Japan's POW camps. At some point, medical doctor Major Lloyd Goad was transferred to the Japan mainland. He spent time at the Naoesu POW camp, which was made famous by the book and movie Unbroken, which detailed Olympic sprinter Louis Zamperini's POW experiences. Every day, the malnourished, exhausted Naoesu POWs marched 1 mile each way to slog through work at a local steel mill. But perhaps Major Goad was spared that hard labor, instead working in a medical capacity. By the way, Zamperini was captured after his bomber crashed into the Pacific Ocean in May 1943. Major Goad was later transferred across the island to Omori POW camp near Tokyo. This camp sat on a small man-made island built by POWs. Interestingly, Louis Zamperini also was a prisoner at this camp, although I don't know if their stays overlapped. Another individual at both the Naoesu and Omori POW camps was Mutsuhiro Watanabe, a Japanese guard nicknamed the Bird. The Bird was known for brutality.
I treated the prisoners strictly, as enemies of Japan,
Watanabe later recalled of his wartime actions. Post-war, he was number 23 on General MacArthur's list of top 40 war criminals, although the guard was never captured or punished. 44 years after his release, Goad wrote,
"My thoughts were of Watanabe, and what would happen if I ever met him again. Not pleasant thoughts for years to come."
American forces liberated Major Goad and his fellow Omori prisoners in September 1945. The now 33-year-old survived 5 months in war zone hospitals and then 40 months as a prisoner of war. A few years ago, I met a World War II medic veteran who told me about working on the boys liberated from Japanese camps. He recalled, still revolted, the awful physical condition these men were in. And Dr. Lloyd Goad treated these kinds of cases, and worse, for some 4 years. It must have been indescribably horrific. Lloyd Goad returned home and married Lois Otto in January 1948. The couple soon moved to Golden, Colorado, where Dr. Goad began practicing medicine. He and Lois raised 3 sons and 1 daughter in Golden, and eventually, Lloyd partnered with his son, a third-generation Goad family doctor, before retiring in 1980 after 52 years in private practice. After the war, Dr. Goad remained involved in 2 ex-POW organizations. In 1949, he returned to Japan, where he testified in the war crimes tribunals. 40 years later, in 1989, Dr. Goad wrote a memoir of his POW experiences, which he called A Guest of the Emperor. Dr. Lloyd Henry Goad died on March 19, 2002. He was 88 years old. Today he rests in the Golden Cemetery in Colorado. Myrtle Boudreau lived near San Francisco, California, when her husband, Colonel Napoleon Boudreau, returned from war. And I wish I could tell you that they lived happily ever after, but their reunion didn't last long. In January 1947, only 15 months after returning home, Napoleon married a woman named Catherine Wright in San Francisco. I believe that he and Myrtle had divorced, because just a few months after Napoleon married Catherine, a woman who I believe to be Myrtle Boudreau married another man in San Francisco. Colonel Boudreau retired from the U.S. Army in 1948 after 40 years of service. Catherine and Napoleon adopted an infant daughter in the late 1950s, and they lived in Santa Rosa, California throughout the 1960s and into the 70s. 83-year-old Napoleon Boudreau died on October 31st, 1971 in Santa Rosa. And today, he rests in the Santa Rosa Memorial Park. Back in May 1942, Major Goad and the other Corregidor POWs were marched through the streets of Manila in a show of Japanese supremacy over America. With them was a young Navy ensign, sick and delirious from malaria, and being cared for, as much as possible, by my great-grandfather. So be sure to hit the follow button, because there will be more on that in the next POW story. This is Left Behind. Thanks for listening. You can find pictures, maps, and sources about Lloyd Goad and Napoleon Boudreau's stories on the Left Behind website, Facebook page, and on Instagram at Left Behind Podcast. The links are all in the show description. If you enjoy this podcast, please subscribe so you'll know when I drop a new episode, and consider leaving a review. Left Behind is researched, written, and produced by me, Anastasia Harmon. Voiceovers by Tyler Harmon and Paul Sutherland. Dramatizations are based on historical research, although some creative liberty is taken with dialogue and scene details. And remember to subscribe to Left Behind, because you won't want to miss the POW's humiliating march through Manila.